A note to listeners, this episode contains adult content. It's January 23, 1994, in a quiet suburban neighborhood in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A family is enjoying their Sunday dinner ritual, pizza and television. Tonight, Mom and Dad have let their 11-year-old son, Billy, pick the evening's programming. Dad grabs a beer and turns to Billy.
Well, son, what's it gonna be? America's funniest home videos?
Billy studies the TV guide, then looks up with a big grin.
Nah, I want to watch this movie. Treasure Island, The Adventure Begins.
Billy's folks look at each other and shrug. Billy commands the remote and tunes into NBC. The one-hour show is the story of a young boy and his family on vacation in Las Vegas. They're staying at a new resort hotel, Steve Wynn's latest multi-million dollar move in redesigning Vegas. But the Treasure Island Hotel has more in common with Disneyland's Pirates of the Caribbean than a casino on the Strip. Billy watches wide-eyed as the story unfolds. A kid, just about his age, is in the lobby staring in awe at a life-sized painting of a pirate. Then, a man approaches him.
Hey, mate. It appears you like pirates.
Yeah, I'm really into Long John Silver.
Me too.
You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a pirate.
Oh, yeah? Me too.
Who are you, anyway? You staying here?
Well, I sort of work here. I'm the head pirate. Name's Steve Wynn.
The hour-long TV feature is Wynn's barely disguised infomercial for his new hotel. He paid NBC $1.7 million for the ultra-desirable prime-time slot.
Is this really your hotel?
Well, to me, it's more than a hotel. It's a gateway between fantasy and reality. And for you, Robbie, my mate, the adventure is about to begin.
The show is selling Wynn's vision of the new Vegas zeitgeist. It's enchanting. It's exotic. It's a family-friendly amusement park. And there's not a poker chip or a slot machine in sight. In other words, it has nothing to do with what Las Vegas has been for the last 50 years. But it works. In the family living room, young Billy is sold. And it won't be long before he seals the deal with his parents. His dad visualizes showgirls while his mom sees herself lounging at the pool, margarita in hand, after a Barbra Streisand performance. It's the brand new American dream, a city that offers a diversion for everyone. As long as you don't mind digging a little deeper into your pockets.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. In our last episode, Steve Wynn relentlessly pursued his dream of becoming the resort hotel king of Las Vegas. He pulled out all the stops to build high-end hotels. His rival and reigning titan was mega entrepreneur Kirk Kerkorian, who mysteriously bowed out of Vegas dominance to pursue other interests in his vast financial empire. But as the corporate kings, Kerkorian and Wynn broke the mob's decades-long stranglehold over Vegas gaming. Financing is no longer provided by the Teamsters or Mormon bankers, but by Wall Street. And though it would seem Wynn's family-friendly vision is well-timed, it's about to set off yet another war on the bloody battlefield of the Strip. In a bizarre twist for the desert mecca built on gambling and other wicked pleasures, the next billion-dollar bet will be won by the one who offers the most magical experience for children. This is Episode 6 of The Birth of Vegas, Gambling on the Future. Las Vegas, 1994. Frankie and Carmine are longtime low-level Vegas mobsters. They're also keen observers of the inner workings of the town and victims of the changing business world in Sin City. The two men are having their morning coffee in their favorite greasy spoon off Fremont Street. It's an old downtown Las Vegas, a different world from the glitzy and Disney-esque strip.
So, Frankie, what do you think of this guy, Wynn?
I'll tell you what I think. I think he's the last nail in our coffin. He worships Disney. I heard him say it on TV. Says he's not making casinos, he's making goddamn themed environments. Starting a trend, Carmine.
I know. Circus was enough for me. Clowns and gals on a trapeze? Come on. But now you got Excalibur with the whole medieval thing. The Luxor pretending to be Egypt. The MGM Grand looking like old-time Hollywood. And this Treasure Island pirate fantasy thing? We're talking full-on motifs, Frankie. Motifs. Who knows what's next?
The theme development is only beginning. Very soon, the Strip will offer resort casinos that simulate Paris, New York City, and Venice. Not to mention the Stratosphere, a recreation of Seattle's Space Needle, complete with thrill rides on top, 1,000 feet above the desert. Frankie reaches for the sweetened loaf. He rips open 3 packets and slowly pours them into his black coffee.
You gotta admit, Carmine, Wynn's a smart player. Parents want to travel with kids these days, so give the rugrats something to do while the folks blow their college tuition in the casino.
Yeah, I know it's true, but you don't stop there, man. Now these hotels got Gucci, Armani, Chanel, boutiques for crying out loud. Whatever happened to the Rat Pack? What happened to Elvis? Where does this leave guys like us?
In the cold, my friend.
In 1994, Time magazine bestows the seal of wholesome approval on Las Vegas with a cover story, Las Vegas, the new all-America city. The piece details the booming business of Vegas. Tourism has doubled in the last decade to over 20 million visitors annually. The cost of building resort hotels has topped $1 billion, the price tag of Kerkorian's MGM Grand. Where Vegas was once a destination for well-dressed adults seeking the specific pleasures of gambling and partying, Time magazine notes the city now caters to the classlessness of the Nike and T-shirt crowd, and the story quotes the man it calls the city's most important and interesting resident, Steve Wynn. Las Vegas exists because it is a perfect reflection of America, Wynn says. You say Las Vegas, anywhere in the world, and people smile. They understand. It represents all the things people in every city in America like. Here, they can get it in one gulp. But the journey from thriving mob haven to respectable part of the nation's fabric has changed the city's vibe, its mood, its character. And in 1995, even aging Fremont Street gets a facelift. In December, the $70 million Fremont Street Experience is unveiled. And this new experience has nothing to do with its old image. The desperate losers, wandering prostitutes, and the scent of urine wafting on the desert breeze. The development features a canopy over 4 blocks where cars are now forbidden.
As pedestrians stroll, an overhead light show is presented at regular intervals to the music of the Nevada Symphony. The experience is owned and funded by a local corporation of casino owners. And it works. Fremont Street tourism quickly climbs by 60%, turning the whole area around. By 1996, Vegas is the top travel destination in the country, with Orlando, Florida's Disney World, running second. But by the late 1990s, it's evident that the Disney-fied Vegas is not the magically profitable fantasia the corporate world has hoped for. There are just too many distractions in family Vegas. Visitors can shop at upscale boutiques or bargain malls. They can enjoy celebrity chef restaurants and an increased variety of entertainment, from acts like Radiohead to Cirque du Soleil. But the real financial heartbeat of the city was, is, and always will be gaming. And that can't be replaced by warring pirate ships, flaming volcanoes, or sharks in the lobby. It's time for Vegas to grow up again. And Steve Wynn is ready to step up and usher in yet another new phase. Wynn's newest power move is impressive, even by Vegas standards. The $1.6 billion Italian-style Bellagio, with 4,000 rooms. The sheer grandiosity of the high-end mega resort dwarfs even his Mirage Hotel. Local government reroutes streets and sewer lines and allows the hotel's 540-foot tower to rise into FAA-designated airspace. Any risk is worth it if it's all good for the city's business. The brand new Bellagio opens on October 15, 1998. Rooms start at $200 a night, or upwards of $300 in today's money. And the resort features gourmet restaurants and designer shops. It also has a $40 million replica of Italy's Lake Como, featuring fountains spouting hundreds of feet into the sky, accompanied by the operatic strains of Pavarotti. Wynn is on a tear. His shareholders wince as he buys top-tier art. Picasso, Van Gogh, Cezanne, traveling the world to acquire a collection that rivals the best museums. He spends over $300 million on paintings. Never one to shy away from hyperbole, Wynn tells the press, Bellagio is the greatest hotel ever built in any century. A resort designed to be an alternative to Paris on a weekend. And that would be an adult weekend, because the Bellagio strongly discourages guests under 21. But this mega resort is also a mega risk. Other luxury resorts like Mandalay Bay, Paris, Las Vegas, and the Venetian are competing for the high-rolling adult dollars. And there are 40,000 more rooms on the Strip than there were when the highly profitable Mirage opened 10 years ago. And now that Wynn is focused on Bellagio, someone else is focusing on the Mirage. It's spring 1999. In his private office at the MGM Grand, Kurt Kerkorian is meeting with his top people. Next to him is a new hire, his young Wall Street-trained CFO, Jim Murin. The topic is expansion. Kerkorian's passion for deal-making is insatiable. The boss looks around the table and locks eyes with Murin.
I want to buy the Mirage. I've been picking up stock in Wynn's company when I can, and I want to make serious plans to acquire it. Murin is shocked. It's a bold move.
All due respect, Kirk, but why not go after something, smaller? Harrah's, for example. Wynn will never sell off the Mirage.
Kerkorian gives a slight smile, then begins to speak. As Murin listens in rapt attention, Kerkorian launches into a fable about an alligator on a riverbank gazing at a tiny fish. He's hungry, but he ignores the small fish, waiting patiently.
After a long while, a particularly big, succulent-looking fish swam by. The alligator gulped the fish whole.
Kerkorian pauses for effect.
You know, I believe we can be just like the alligator. Thanks for your time, gentlemen. Murin thinks to himself, they don't talk like this on Wall Street. But the marching orders are clear. The boss is determined to get the Mirage. And he's willing to wait. By 1999, Wynn's Mirage in the desert is in trouble. And it's no rippling illusion either. Wynn's new Bellagio has been sucking guests away from his older hotel. And his ban on visitors under 21 has extended to all of his hotels, driving families away. Competing strip hotels like Mandalay Bay and the Venetian are offering comparable luxury at lower prices and with a much less pompous attitude. Vegas needs to sell fun, and the Mirage and Bellagio are getting a stuffy reputation. Outside of Vegas losses, Wynn spends $685 million on a casino project in Biloxi, Mississippi. According to Forbes magazine, in 1999, Wynn's Mirage Resorts Company drops a staggering $233 million on promotion alone. Kerkorian's MGM Grand is thriving, having spent less than half that amount. The spending spree leaves Mirage Resorts some $2 billion in debt. Stock values are dropping to $12 a share. Kerkorian quietly purchases undervalued Mirage stock like mad, picking up some 10 million shares. And Vegas industry watchers predict Wynn's empire could crumble. After all this time, the alligator is waiting. February 2000. Steve Wynn is fast asleep in his Vegas mansion. Wynn reaches for the phone, barely awake.
Hello?
He immediately recognizes the voice on the other end, Kirk Kerkorian.
Sorry to wake you, Steve. How about I buy the Mirage?
In an instant, Wynn is wide awake.
Are you joking, Kirk?
No. Meet me for lunch tomorrow. I'll come to your place.
The next morning, at the Bellagio, the two kings sit down over coconut sorbet. Kerkorian makes an offer above the current stock price. It's a takeover move. Wynn knows it can be hostile or friendly, but it's inevitable. The men quickly work out the basic points. They smile and shake hands, sealing a $4.4 billion deal. Now, with holdings around the world, Kerkorian controls almost half of the gaming industry. Wynn has been rescued from ruin. And both men think they came out the winner. By the early 2000s, annual Vegas tourism tops 37 million. More people visit Sin City than go to Mecca. And tourists spend $2 billion more on non-gaming activities than they do on Sin City's original gambling draw. The Vegas stakes have never been higher. But there's another alligator lying in wait, and Steve Wynn is about to launch a major strike against Kerkorian in what the national press will call the biggest casino war the gambling capital has ever seen.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. We get support from Airbnb. Staying in an Airbnb is often one of my favorite parts of a trip, especially on business travel. Instead of slogging to another hotel and waiting in line after you've been driving or flying all day, there is nothing better than landing in a place that, well, really feels like a home away from home. Maybe you've stayed in an Airbnb before and thought to yourself, you know, this actually seems pretty doable. Maybe my place could be an Airbnb. Well, I'm here to tell you it could be. You could be sitting on an Airbnb and not even know it. It might be as simple as starting with your spare room, or maybe even your whole place when you're away. Say you and your family are headed away for a much-deserved spring break. Well, why not Airbnb your place and make some extra money towards the trip? Win-win! Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. It's February 2005 on Wall Street in New York City. Two young financial analysts are having cocktails in a Manhattan bar, but their minds are firmly planted in Las Vegas.
Here's to Sin City, eh, bro?
Oh, yeah. It's the place to invest, and it's no secret construction is on fire.
The U.S. economic boom has brought serious dividends to Wall Street. Banks, hedge funds, and almost anyone else with ready cash is looking to invest in Vegas. Steve Wynn has rebounded and is set to open his most lavish resort yet, Wynn's Las Vegas, the first new resort on the Strip in 5 years. In 2004, the two Vegas Titans mega developments were announced almost simultaneously. Wynn's Las Vegas debuts in April 05. It's actually a third of the size of the Bellagio, with a mere 2,700 rooms. By Wynn standards, it's practically a boutique hotel. The hotels are as much of an attraction as the gambling. Tourism is way up. Sin City is cool again.
You've been following Wynn's new place? $2.7 billion to build that thing. I know. 3-acre lake and a world-class golf course. Did you know in front there's an 18-story mountain? Jeez, a mountain. And don't forget the freaking Maserati dealership, but still, that's nothing compared to Kerkorian's project. I hear it's setting him back $7.5 billion. Hey, maybe we should be working on the Strip instead of Wall Street. Huh. We practically are, bro.
In December 2008, Wynn opens the $2.8 billion Encore luxury resort, echoing the elegant, languid feel of Saint-Tropez. His target clientele is no longer the American tourist binging on buffets or vacationing families either. He wants to reel in international gamblers who think nothing of betting $10,000 or more per hand. In industry terms, he's hunting whales. Kerkorian hasn't built a hotel since the MGM Grand rose in 1986. But in 2004, he returns to Vegas, spending $4.8 billion to add the Mandalay Resort Group to his holdings. Now, he's not just interested in building a bigger, flashier resort and casino. Kerkorian has grander ambitions. He wants to build a city within a city. City Center is a mixed-use facility on 76 acres featuring casinos, hotels, and commercial and residential developments. The staff alone is over 12,000 workers. Corporations and hotels up and down the Strip are merging, consolidating power, and expanding. Construction is holding strong. Excess and decadence are at an all-time high. And for Sin City, that's saying something. Vegas, it seems, is on an economic winning streak. But that luck is about to change.
Traders here working the phone say a lot of their customers are freaked out, waiting to see how low the Dow will go. They're focused on the Dow, not so focused on OPEC.
In 2008, the subprime mortgage crisis hits the country hard, and Vegas is ground zero for the economic pain. Banks foreclose on nearly 2.5 million homes nationwide. In Vegas and the surrounding Clark County, nearly 70% of the homes are underwater. The official jobless rate hovers at 14%.
Americans are in no mood for freewheeling partying in Vegas. Within a year, Vegas is in financial survival mode. Gambling profits tumble almost 25%. Casino stocks on Wall Street plummet. Construction grinds to a halt, leaving behind hulking, half-built structures dotting the city skyline. And in 2010, President Obama twists the knife in a New Hampshire town hall meeting, effectively telling Americans not to go to Las Vegas.
Right? When times are tough, you tighten your belts. You don't go buying a boat when you can barely pay your mortgage. You don't blow a bunch of cash on Vegas when you're trying to save for college. You prioritize. You make tough choices.
But as the country's economy slowly heals itself, so does Vegas. By 2013, tourism picks up, and the Strip is booming once again. In 2015, Kirk Kerkorian dies rich at 98, leaving Wynn as the sole remaining king of the Vegas business war. But 3 years later, Wynn's reign takes a tumble for reasons that have nothing to do with business, as ABC News reports.
Late today, a scandal erupting in Las Vegas. The Wall Street Journal reporting casino mogul Steve Wynn, one of the most powerful men in that city and a powerful player in politics in this country, accused of sexual misconduct.
Wynn immediately denies the allegations, calling them preposterous. The negative backlash forces him to resign as chairman and CEO of Wynn Resorts. His ex-wife, Elaine, takes over. The Nevada Gaming Control Board begins an investigation, and in July 2020, a federal judge dismisses a lawsuit against Wynn Resorts Limited, filed by 9 anonymous female employees, all manicurists and makeup artists. The federal judge ruled that the women's version of events were vague and didn't support their allegations. Still, the judge dismisses without prejudice, meaning they could file the suit again. Las Vegas is always changing, evolving. The Vegas Strip is now owned largely by corporations, and consolidation is king. Two companies own 17 of the city's 29 large hotels. And the growth isn't stopping. In June of 2021, the $4.3 billion Resorts World joined the fray. It opened the first new casino on the Strip in more than a decade, not to mention the most costly. The high-tech resort is owned by a Malaysia-based conglomerate, the Genting Berhad Group. It seems like nearly an eternity ago, when two L.A. mobsters drove into town on a dusty highway in 1942. Meyer Lansky and Ben Siegel pioneered an industry that went well beyond anything they ever could have imagined. Today, the city's gangster presence has been relegated to the Mob Museum, a popular attraction in the old courthouse building. Love it or hate it, there's no place on the planet like Las Vegas. The mega business of Sin City has survived, changing hands through the generations. The terrain has grown radically, from cheap sawdust card rooms to Disney-fied theme park attractions to multi-billion-dollar luxury resorts. But the constant evolution is tied together with one continuous thread. Vegas makes money.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is episode 6 of The Birth of Vegas for Business Wars. A quick note about recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said at the time. Those scenes are dramatizations. But they're based on historical research. And you should note, we use many sources when researching our stories, but we especially recommend The Money and the Power by Sally Denton and Roger Morris, Running Scared by John L. Smith, The Gambler by William C. Rempel, The Strip, Las Vegas, and the Symbolic Destruction of Spectacle by Stefan Johan, The Battle for Las Vegas by Dennis N. Griffin, and Las Vegas, An Unconventional History by Michelle Ferrari and Stephen Ives.
I'm your host, David Brown. Peter Gilstrap wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound designed by Kyle Randall. Our associate producer is Kate Young. Dave Schilling is our producer. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.